Good morning. This is the reading of the Lynn Daily Item for Tuesday, February 17th, 2026. I'm Mark White of the Talking Information Center. Good morning to you all. On the front page of the Lynn Daily Item this morning, Peabody unites for life-saving heart screenings. As teenagers lined up inside the Torrigian family YMCA on Monday, rolling up their sleeves for a five-minute heart test, two families stood by, nearby, knowing exactly why it mattered. At a heart screening event held in partnership with the Espinal and Facey families, more than 90 young people with additional walk-ins pushing the total past 100 received electrocardiogram screenings aimed at detecting a silent, life-threatening heart conditions. We Who Play For, a nonprofit with a mission of eliminating preventable sudden cardiac death in the young through affordable heart screenings, AEDs, and working with communities to honor every kid who never had the chance, joined forces to host the event. The event was held in memory of Freddie Espinal, a Peabody student-athlete who died at 17 following a sudden cardiac emergency during wrestling practice. His family has since become advocates. For mandatory heart screenings for young athletes, backing legislation known as Freddie's Law. "We're doing a heart screening in memory of my brother," Freddie's sister, Alexis Espinal, said. "We're trying to pass this law to make this a requirement." She said this has pushed many of Freddie's friends and teammates to get screened as well. Freddie's story is a heartbreakingly similar to that of 18-year-old Jason Facey, Jr., a Framingham State University soccer player who died suddenly in August of 2024 from hypertrophic obstructive cardiomyopathy, a condition that often goes undetected until a catastrophic event occurs. Facey's family has joined the Espinals in advocating for legislation that would require EKG screenings as part of high school sports physicals. Under House Bill 5046, high school athletes in Massachusetts would be required to undergo an electrocardiogram screening prior to participating in school sports. The bill also mandates insurance coverage for the test, protecting families from additional costs. The legislation is currently under review by the Joint Committee on Healthcare Financing after receiving favorable movement from financial services. Jason Facey's father said, "Considering that the first sign could be the last, the state of Massachusetts will not check the heart of a young athlete or anyone unless they have an issue and they live through it. We are trying to fill the gap in the healthcare marketplace until the state of Massachusetts can step up and provide this service to families, athletes, and communities alike." Melissa Facey, JJ's mother, added, "There's no intense review of one's heart. They don't do EKGs, and it's not required as a standard physical for the youth today." State Representative Tom Walsh, who filed the bill after meeting with the Espinal family, called the proposal a common-sense preventive measure. "We ended up filing legislation that would require that if you're playing a high school sport as part of your physical, the EKG would be included." While acknowledging pushback from the insurance industry, he emphasized that advocates are now working through cost analysis to demonstrate that the screenings represent a very small investment for a huge return. Walsh also praised the families leading the effort. "These families are incredible," he said. "I don't know if I was in the situation that they're in, that I could find the strength to go out and do what they are doing." Standard sports physicals typically involve a stethoscope exam, not an EKG, the only screening tool capable of detecting certain electrical abnormalities of the heart. registered nurse Emily Knight, who is also the heart screening director for New England and a volunteer for Who We Play For, said that while structural heart conditions like hypertrophic cardiomyopathy can sometimes be identified, electrical orders cannot be detected after death and often show no outward symptoms. There are several problems that you can have with your electricity that are only detectable on an EKG, she explained. They can't be found at a doctor's office with a regular listening to their heart and lungs. This is the one screening tool that will make this difference. Knight said that oftentimes they find abnormalities in students who are screened during these events requiring further evaluation. At a recent charter school screening week, 89 students were screened and 6 abnormal results were identified. At a following event, 33 students were screened and 4 abnormalities were found. If we can catch one kid that doesn't end up making a sad family like JJ's or Freddy's, Knight said, then it's worth it. This is the one screening tool that will make that difference to catch these abnormalities in these kids. The screenings are conducted by trained medical professionals with the results uploaded securely and reviewed by pediatric cardiologists. Families receive follow-up emails, letters, and phone calls if an abnormality is detected. Kylie Liberty, sports director and assistant camp director at the YMCA, said she was a student athlete in college on the ice hockey team. She said many of her teammates also had heart conditions they didn't know about until they started playing a competitive team sport. She added, "I think it's great for the kids to get tested early and have that option. For many volunteers, the cause is very personal." Addison Merrill, a close friend of Freddie's, has helped organize clinics since his passing. "It could have been prevented with a simple EKG," Merrill said. "That was the reasoning. It could have been prevented, but it was not seen or caught quickly enough." Freddie's cousin, Gino Rowe, said the event is about raising awareness among younger athletes. "It's just exposure," he said. "I'm here supporting my family." Screenings have taken place at Peabody High School with another scheduled there in April. Organizers say more events are planned throughout Massachusetts, including a large-scale 2-day screening this summer at the Dana Barrows Basketball Club in Stoughton, where the facility has been donated free of charge. The event will take place on July 18th from noon to 6 and on July 19th from 10 to 4. Advocates say they'll continue hosting screenings until statewide legislation is passed. For families like the Espinals and the Faces, with every young athlete who sits down for a 5-minute EKG, they move one step closer to turning heartbreak into protection. Inspiring story of those two families. Also on the front page, the Swampscott Board approves the Richdale liquor license upgrade. The Swampscott Select Board voted to approve 2 alcohol-related license matters during a recent public hearing, including a closely watched upgrade for Richdale on an expansion of Pomona Restaurant on Humphrey Street. The board voted 3-2 to approve an amendment allowing 44 Atlantic Inc., doing business as Richdale, to convert its existing Section 15 off-premises wine and malt beverage license to an all-alcohol license. The matter had previously been discussed in December when several related changes, including updates to management and the corporate offices, were approved. The remaining question before the board was whether to grant the license upgrade. During the hearing, Chair Katie Phelan read into the record a letter of opposition from abutters George Allen, Gregory Allen, and Sarah Spedden. The residents wrote that while they understand the financial benefits of an expanded alcohol license, they believe the current beer and wine license was sufficient for that location. They noted that a full liquor store operates nearby in Humphrey Street and argued that another all-alcohol license was unnecessary in a residential neighborhood. After confirming the public hearing was properly reopened and the letter was entered into the record, the board turned into discussion. Attorney Chris Drukas, representing the applicant, said the only outstanding issue was the upgrade to a full liquor license, as other proposed changes had already been approved at the December meeting. Phelan said she had carefully reviewed the issue following what she described as a robust conversation at the earlier meeting. She said she looked to case law and the specific criteria under which the board could deny such an application. I don't feel like any of those reasons exist here, Phelan said, noting that Swampscott's compact 3-square-mile size means proximity between licensed establishments is common. She added that it did not make sense to withhold the license from a business owner seeking to use it appropriately. Vice Chair Doug Thompson acknowledged that valid concerns had been raised, but said he was familiar with how the store operates and expressed confidence that the owners would be sensitive to neighborhood considerations in implementing the changes. The board then voted to approve the amendment. 2 members voted in opposition. Member Mary Ellen Fletcher noted that her no vote was based solely on the belief that adding another liquor store within a half mile in a small community did not benefit the town, emphasizing that her decision was not a reflection on the store's ownership. With a majority in favor, the measure passed, clearing the way for Richdale to move forward with expanded alcohol sales. The board also unanimously approved a request from 128 Humphrey Street Food Service doing business as Pomona to alter and expand its licensed premises under its existing wine and malt beverage license. The proposal involves incorporating a former adjacent hair salon into the restaurant's footprint, bringing the total space to approximately 2,760 feet. Plans include a new service bar with 10 seats, 2 handicap accessible restrooms, and an additional dining area with 10 tables and roughly 30 seats. There was initial clarification during the hearing regarding whether the restaurant was seeking to upgrade to a full liquor license. Owner Oscar Guerrero confirmed that Pomona is not requesting a change in license type and will continue operating under its wine and malt beverage license, simply extending the service into the new added space. Guerrero told the board that the changes are intended to improve guest circulation and service flow, not to increase noise or extend operating hours. He said the restaurant remains in full compliance with state and local alcohol regulations and the staff are properly trained and certified. Board members asked about the timeline and compliance measures, including tips certification for bartenders. Guerrero said construction is nearly complete and that the restaurant expects to open the expanded space soon. The board voted unanimously to approve the alteration of premises, formally allowing alcohol service to extend into the expanded area. Also on the front page, Saugus awaits revised Pranker Mills plans. In Saugus, the Pranker Mills project, which involves developing apartments on the site at 180 Central Street, has encountered several roadblocks since it was brought to the table. The issues persist as the planning board waits for the required plans to move the project forward. Project manager Pat Scully, who was recently brought on to push the project toward completion, and Joe Bocelli II both attended the board meeting to provide updates on the project. Scully noted that he has received the red line plans for the interior of the building, showing the areas that have changed. We still had issues with the transformer in the wall, which I got a letter today from National Grid and their legal departments issuing that the whole process right there was a firewall, not meant to be a blast wall, and that it covers their requirements. O'Brien said that it wasn't on any plan the board has seen yet, to which Scully said he hasn't gotten the chance to submit it yet as he had just received the letter. The board also informed that while it was believed the site had 2 walls on it, it was actually one singular wall that comes up to the transformer. The project is also working with the Conservation Commission as the site includes the Saugus River. I want to get to the point where we can get the power turned on in the building, get the heat on, and eventually get the water in. We've been at a standstill now for 3 weeks, so right now I've got contractors waiting to be paid. I got people waiting to finish their jobs, he said. Regarding the inside of the building and the red line plans, Chair Joe O'Brien stated that the board has no jurisdiction inside. So we're looking for the red line items for the walls, the transformer location. None of that was on the original plans. There were a few things. Town engineer Todd Baldwin stated that anything new or changed should be put on the red lines for the board. Bocelli II, who took over the project from his father and his director of construction at Sleeping Dog Properties, then spoke to the board. "I understand we had to submit the exterior and transformer location. We're just trying to work together to get this thing done off my family's plate. And though there's been a lot of back and forth between my father and brother and whoever else, I'm not them," Bocelli said. He said the project has stressed the family out and that he is brought in to take it to completion. "My father was sick. He had cancer. He's okay now. But during the time, he was preoccupied and didn't do things maybe the way that they should have been. That's not how I do business. That's not how we as a company do construction," he said. Bocelli II wanted to assure the board that everything would get to them in a timely fashion. Before the meeting concluded, Special Town Council Jesse Schomer noted that they are required to include inclusionary housing in the project. "They were supposed to do it before the building permit was issued. I recommend that you get started on that ASAP. Let the developer know about it, because for the last project where we had to do this, it took about 6 months due to delays and how slow things were at the state level with getting these agreements." Also on the front page this morning, the select review of Nahant, the FY27 budget. The Nahant Select Board recently reviewed the first draft of the FY27 budget, presenting both a level services plan and a $1 million operating override option. "In December 26, I sent out budget templates to each of the department heads to complete," said Allison Nito, town administrator, noting the forms included historical spending data and current year budgets. "Requests were due January 20th, followed by individual meetings through February 2nd. After compiling the submissions, it became clear they exceeded the Prop 2.5 limits. As I spoke to the board last week, the request was not going to fit in our normal Prop 2.5 increase on taxes. As a result, Nito prepared two presentations, one I termed as a level services budget and one as an over-operating override budget. The 2.5 tax levy increase would generate about $285,000, with an estimated $70,000 in new growth. Water and sewer debt payments will drop by roughly $55,000, and FY27 school override debt, which was $295,800 in FY26, will be fully paid off in FY27. However, free cash has declined from $810,000 in FY26 to just over $300,000 for FY27, resulting in a net revenue decrease of about $81,000. The level services budget totals $16.9 million in funds contractual increases, 2.5% for DPW, police, and fire unions in their final year of contracts, 3.5% for teachers, and 2.5% for non-union staff. It also includes a projected 12% increase in health insurance. "My level services budget includes a 12% increase in health insurance," Nito said, explaining the town is exploring lower premium options after employees absorbed an 18% hike this year. The plan does not include a stabilization transfer due to limited capacity. The override budget totals $17.9 million and would fund expanded staffing in the schools and fire departments, salary adjustments for 5 under-market non-union positions, larger part-time wage increases, higher utility budgets, and a $56,000 stabilization transfer. The school department has requested increasing a 0.37 FTE ELA math specialist to full-time and boosting professional development funding. The fire department has requested 4 additional fire-time firefighters. In a letter read into the record, Fire Chief Austin Antrim wrote, "One significant reason for the proposed general override is the fire department is seeking more full-time staffing. Nahant Fire Department does not have sufficient staffing to be able to safely extinguish a fire in a low-hazard occupancy based on current national firefighting standards." He concluded, "It is my sincere hope that you'll join me in providing this information to the residents of Nahant so they can make an informed decision about the level of fire protection they are willing to fund. We need a little more time and information to make an informed decision, said Vice Chair Eugene Canty. Under the override scenario, the tax rate would increase by an estimated $68 per $1,000 of valuation. For the average single-family home valued just over $1 million, that would mean an annual increase of about $730. Nahant's current residential tax rate ranks 49th statewide. Chairman Robert Tebow informed the board of a potential new out-of-district special education placement that could cost approximately $382,000 annually, though details are still being finalized and are not included in either budget version. Enterprise funds will also see increases. Water and sewer rates are projected to rise 3.9% after reflecting contractual raises, outside assessments, and indirect costs. Trash fees could increase 6% pending negotiations with waste management, bringing the annual rate from $429 to an estimated $455 per household. Board members emphasized the limited flexibility within a level services plan and declined to consider tapping stabilization funds. I would not support taking funds from the stabilization account. The board voted unanimously to forward both budget versions, including a $350 increase for planning board supplies to the Advisory and Finance Committee for review. Town meeting is scheduled for May 16th. If an override is approved there, it would proceed to a ballot vote. We've got 9 weeks to do it in, recording Secretary Patrick O'Reilly said. Looking forward to the debate. And also on the front page of the Lynn Daily item this morning, the Veterans Council in Lynn opens a second campus scholarship. More than four decades after the death of Lance Corporal Bradley Campus, his name continues to resonate in his hometown, not only through a memorial at Clark Street Playground, rededicated in 2023, but through a growing scholarship program for local high school seniors. Campus, a graduate of Lynn English High School, was among 241 U.S. service members killed in the 1983 bombing of the Marine Barracks in Beirut. The attack marked one of the deadliest days for the U.S. Marine Corps since World War II. Today, his memory is being preserved in a way that reaches directly into the next generation. After completing a recent memorial-related project, members of the Lynn Veterans Council found themselves with surplus funds. Rather than let the money go unused, they chose to establish the Bradley J. Campus Memorial Scholarship. We had extra money and were thinking about what kind of cause it could support, said Charles Griffin, president of the Lynn Veterans Council. Someone suggested a scholarship, and it was the perfect idea. Last year marked the inaugural rounds of the awards. Three $1,000 scholarships were presented, two to students from Lynn English and one to a student from Lynn Tech. Applicants were required to complete a detailed packet, submit resumes, provide academic transcripts, and highlight their volunteer work and community involvement. Griffin said the quality of applicants made the selection process especially challenging. The applications were fantastic. It was so hard to pick just three. These were truly outstanding kids, strong academically and very involved in volunteering and giving back to the community. To ensure fairness, organizers used a scoring rubric to evaluate the submissions. This year, scholarship packets have been distributed to six high schools across the city, including alternative schools, to broaden access and ensure all eligible seniors have an opportunity to apply. The applications are due on March 27th, but are expected to be reviewed in late May or early June. Griffin noted that the packets containing all the information and requirements were distributed to all six high schools in the city for students who are interested in applying. While the financial support is meaningful, Griffin emphasized that the scholarship's deeper purpose is remembrance. With that special and untimely sacrifice, remember them any way you can. Each time you remember them or say their name, they're not really gone. The scholarship is open to graduating seniors, regardless of whether they plan to serve in the military. Funds may be used at the recipient's discretion, whether for tuition, housing, books, or other educational expenses. Griffin noted that last year's recipients were high-achieving students who earned multiple scholarships and significant financial aid packages. It's such a good lesson for young people. Whether they choose to serve in the military or not, it's important to understand that there are people who serve this country and are willing to sacrifice their lives. The 2023 rededication of campus's memorial at Clark Street Playground reaffirmed the community's commitment to honoring his service. For Griffin and the Veterans Council, the memorial and the scholarship serve as complementary efforts, one providing a physical place for reflection, the other ensuring campus's story is shared with each new graduating class. It's our duty to remember these people, Griffin said. People can be easily forgotten if their stories are not passed on. This keeps his name on the light and in the light. It reminds students that heroes were once young people themselves, classmates, neighbors, and that their sacrifice should never be taken for granted. As applications come in for the scholarship's second year, organizers hope the program will continue to grow both in participation and in its impact, ensuring that Lance Corporal Bradley J. Campus's legacy remains firmly rooted in the city he called home. And there's just one final story on the front page of the Lynn Daily item today. No, Washington did not have wooden teeth. More than a decade before he became the country's first president, George Washington was a leading critical campaign in the early days of the American Revolution. The Siege of Boston was his first campaign as Commander-in-Chief of the Continental Army, and in many ways set the stage for his military and political successes, celebrated on this President's Day. Following the battles of Lexington and Concord, militias had pinned down the British in Boston in April of 1775. The Continental Congress, recognizing the need for more organized military effort, selected Washington to lead the newly formed army. The Siege of Boston and its significance. On this day, 250 years ago, Washington would have been nearing the end of an almost year-long siege that bottled up as many as 11,000 British troops and hundreds more loyalists. The British were occupying Boston at the time, and the goal of the siege was to force them out. A critical decision made by Washington was sending Henry Knox, a young bookseller, to Fort Ticonderoga in New York to retrieve dozens of cannons. The cannons, transported hundreds of miles in the dead of winter, were eventually used to fire on British positions. That contributed to the decision by the British, facing dwindling supplies, to abandon the city by boat on March 17, 1776. Historians argue that the British abandoning their positions, celebrated in Boston as Evacuation Day, rid the city of loyalists at a critical time, denied the British access to an important port, and gave patriots a huge morale boost. The success of the Siege of Boston gave new life and momentum to the Revolution. Chris Bagan, the site manager at Longfellow House in Cambridge, a national historic site that served as Washington's headquarters during the American Revolution. Had it failed, royal control of New England would have continued, and the Continental Army likely would have dissolved. How the siege shaped Washington. The siege was also critical for Washington. A surveyor and farmer, Washington had been out of the military for nearly 20 years after commanding troops for the British during the French and Indian War. His successful campaign ensured Washington remained the commander-in-chief for the remainder of the Revolution. Doug Bradburn, president of George Washington's Mount Vernon, said Washington took the first steps to creating a geographically diverse army that included militiamen from Massachusetts to Virginia, and by the end of the war, a fighting force with significant Black and Native American representation. It was the most integrated military until President Harry Truman desegregated the armed forces in 1948, he said. Washington, a slave owner who depended on hundreds of slaves on his Mount Vernon estate, was initially opposed to admitting formerly enslaved and freed Black soldiers into the army. But short of men, Washington came to realize there are free Blacks who ought to enlist and needs them to keep the British from breaking out during the siege, Bradburn said. Ridding Boston of the British also turned Washington into one of the country's most popular political figures. He comes to embody the cause in a time before you have a nation, before you have a Declaration of Independence, before you're really sure what is the goal of this struggle. He becomes the face of the revolutionary movement. Commanding the military for more than 8 years also prepared Washington for the presidency, Pulitzer Prize-winning military historian Rick Atkinson said. Perhaps most important, it gave him a sense that Americans could and should be a single people rather than denizens of 13 different entities. Myths of Washington. His rise to prominence also led to plenty of myths about Washington, many which persist to this day. One of the most popular is the cherry tree myth. It was invented by one of Washington's first biographers, according to George Washington's Mount Vernon, who created the story after his death. Supposedly, a six-year-old Washington took an axe to a cherry tree and admitted as much when caught by his father, famously saying, "I cannot tell a lie. I did cut it with my hatchet." The second one is the wooden teeth myth. It was rumored that Washington had wooden dentures, and scholars well into the 20th century were quoted as saying his false teeth were made from wood. Not true. He wore wooden dentures, instead using those with ivory, gold, and even human teeth. Interesting article. To close out today's reading of the Lynn Daily Item. Again, today is February 17th. Have a great week in this warmer weather. I'll read again next Tuesday. This is Mark White of the Talking Information Center.